7th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflaw.
And I'm Pam Bedour.
And we are back again. Back to the short stories. We're going to read through Sherlock Holmes, His Last Bow, some reminiscences of Sherlock Holmes. This one, The Adventure of the Wisteria Lodge, Part 1. This was published in September of 1908. And we're back to the short story format here.
Were you guys happy to get back to the stories?
Well, I enjoyed the last book tremendously, and but I am ready. In fact, I was pleasantly not surprised. I was very happy about how good this first chapter was. It's a nice setup. So if you're joining us for the first time, the last book was wonderful, Study in Scarlet. And this right here looks like it's equally as good. So join us now.
And this is a part one of a two-part story. So this is somewhere in between that short story format and the long form of a novel. This is more of a novelette, maybe?
Yeah, and I kind of love that we stopped at the midpoint so we can really think about what do we know, what do we still need to know. It's kind of fun that way. And I also really enjoyed the preface to His Last Bow, where Watson sets up the reader for this collection of stories. He says, "The friends of Mr. Sherlock Holmes will be glad to learn that he is still alive and well, though somewhat crippled by occasional attacks of rheumatism. He has for many years lived in a small farm upon the downs, 5 miles from Eastbourne, where his time is divided between philosophy and agriculture." So I kind of love this sort of check-in with the much, much older Sherlock Holmes. And he explains that his last bow is going to be in the present, but then he collected some other stories from his portfolio in order to share with us. Now, how does that feel to you guys, thinking about Mr. Sherlock Holmes living out in the country, dividing his time between philosophy and agriculture?
Collecting honey. He's got that little stand on the side of the road. You can stop and pick some up.
I don't think he's selling some Sherlock at the farmer's market.
Maybe. Got a few tomatoes out front that he just picked this morning. And then at the time, you can ask him, "Tell us, Mr. Holmes, tell us a little bit about the past."
I think that he would be a great study for a storytelling course. I think if Sherlock Holmes was a real person, if he was retired, if he was living out his life in the country, I think it would be really interesting to visit him and to hear some of those tales.
Again, this goes to verisimilitude, right? So Sherlock Holmes is not just this fictional character who we're going to see in the prime of his life. He's a guy who'd had all these wonderful adventures, and now he's retired to the country. And that little detail that he suffers from rheumatism, that's so real. So many people suffer from rheumatism. It's part of the aging process. You know, it just feels very accurate and very human.
I think you hit something right there, is that just like all of us, we have a very active part of our life. And, you know, we have a youthful time. We've got this productive time, and then we have a time later in life where maybe we can't do all the things that we did when we were younger. Maybe we have to find different strategies to deal with our time and the things that we enjoy.
And as I've always said, middle age is when your children and your mother yell at you for the same things.
I like that. And remember yesterday when we were having that show where Chip and I kept breaking the rules about what is the best first story. But I mentioned Laurie R. King's Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes series as amazing series. And I think that I really like this idea of visiting Holmes as an older guy, as a man in his 50s, who's just like doing his own thing, but then people keep coming to him with the problems. They find him if it's important enough. And he will help out if absolutely necessary, even in retirement.
So we need to talk about the setting of this particular story. This is set in 1892, which is a very curious date because that is the year after the final problem with the quote-unquote death of Sherlock Holmes, and 2 years before The Empty House with the quote-unquote return of Sherlock Holmes. So the great hiatus, this 1891 to 1894, where we had no Sherlock stories, Was it as empty as you claim, Pam?
Well, and I actually, when you look up a chronology, it says right here in the text, right, that it was March 1892. It's actually usually framed as March 1890 before the final problem, because this is obviously when they're living at Baker Street and Watson is with Holmes. So it should not be in 1892.
So was that a mistake?
I guess it must have been. But I did look, as you might imagine, these 56 stories are put in chronological order by many people. And this one's usually put in 1890, right beside a whole bunch of other stories from right before the final problem.
So what do you think is behind this mistake, if it is a mistake? Doyle didn't care about the concept of the canon and was just writing a story? And if so, why the heck put a year on it at all?
Right. I'm not sure, like, in terms of the sort of material conditions that led to that, but I think that we should think of it as 1890.
Fine. It's 1890. I'll disregard the text and move on.
I know, sorry. And so, guys, but whenever you have 60 stories about the same character, you get a couple mistakes, right?
Yeah.
We haven't come to the mistake where was Watson hit in the shoulder or the leg? We're going to come to that one.
We have gotten to whether shortly. James or John. We have gotten to that.
Exactly. And so that's just, even someone like William Faulkner, Nobel laureate, he has those 19 wonderful novels set in Yaknapatawpha County. And there are 4 mistakes in that. Where someone has the wrong birthday in 2 novels or whatever. So we got to cut them a little bit of slack. It's 60 stories.
Yeah, so we get back to the story here of Sherlock Holmes and John Watson and how their dynamic works.
Now, I love this really early quote in the story where Holmes says, "I suppose, Watson, we must look upon you as a man of letters," said he. "How do you define the word grotesque?" "Strange, remarkable," I suggested. He shook his head at my definition. "There is surely something more than that," said he, "some underlying suggestion of the tragic and the terrible." Now, I love this for so many reasons, because he's looking around for someone who, like, might have an education, some kind of man of letters, which is definitely Watson. But as soon as he asks his advice, bam, no, he's shaking his head. "No, that's not quite right."
I don't think that Sherlock Holmes would be a good patient at any time.
Yes. But that word grotesque is really interesting, right? Because, like, the word, I looked it up because I wasn't at all sure. It comes from the Italian, 16th century Italian. It comes from grotto paintings. And so if you paint something in a grotto, of course, it becomes sort of distorted. And the grotesque is the focus on the distorted body. It's the notion of you have something that's almost normal, but then there's just something a little bit off. And so in some ways, I think Sherlock does have the better definition, because there's that hint of the tragic and the terrible, something that after Freud we might call the uncanny. And so it's a great, great word.
And he brings this up because he got a telegram from Scott Eccles. It says simply, "Have just had most incredible and grotesque experience. May I consult you?" That's simple enough.
And it's such a funny telegram, right?
Well, it's funny in the situation, because the first thing Watson asks about Scott Eccles is that a man or a woman?
And don't you love the answer? I'm sure. So, Steve, why don't you explain the answer and then try to defend
right.
it?
Right. Good luck with it. Sherlock replies, "Oh, a man, of course. No woman would ever send a reply paid telegram. She would have come over." God. Like, what? What does that mean? God. Pam, can you explain? Have you ever sent a reply paid telegram?
I mean, I wouldn't ever send a reply paid telegram.
There you
I
go.
Oh, my God. I have really no idea what that is. But
well, you understand that if you sent somebody a letter and you wanted them to reply, you might send them an envelope with a stamp on it, a self-addressed stamped envelope. That's essentially what a reply paid telegram means.
I'm teasing. Of course, I would just show up at someone's office with my grotesque problem.
Exactly. But you know, you would wait. I mean, like Eccles did, because you know Sherlock Holmes is going to point that out.
And he's waiting at the post office. He's waiting at the post office, sending a telegram to ask if it was okay for him to come over. This is strange, at least.
Proper form, Steve. Proper form.
And I guess, yes, you're right. It does go to that proper form, because we do get a picture of this man as being the most proper person that we could possibly imagine, the most English person. When he arrives an hour or so after he sends the telegram, even his steps are measured. It says a measured step was heard upon the stairs, and a moment later a stout, tall, gray-whiskered, and solemnly respectable person was ushered into the room. His life history was written in his heavy features and pompous manner. From his spats to his gold-rimmed spectacles, he was a conservative, a churchman, a good citizen, orthodox and conventional to the last degree. So yes, this man, this character is as British as you can get.
And I like that Watson is the one who reads his life history on his face, right? And he's totally right. So he's been learning stuff. Now, I thought it was really interesting. You get more of the Sherlock-Watson dynamic as Scott Eccles starts telling his story. And then Holmes says, come, sir, said Holmes, laughing. You are like my friend Dr. Watson, who has a bad habit of telling his stories wrong and foremost. Please arrange your thoughts and let me know in their due sequence exactly what those events are which have sent you out unbrushed and unkempt, with dress boots and waistcoat buttoned awry, in search of advice and assistance. Man, there's a lot of insults in that sentence.
There's a lot going on there. There is a lot going on there. He does tell the story in an unorganized manner to show how flustered he is.
And Watson doesn't. Watson tells the stories beautifully. Come on.
No. I'm saying, you're right. Eccles.
But you know what I mean? Like he says, oh man, you're just like Watson telling stories out of order. And of course, the reason that the stories are out of order to Holmes is that he already has the answers early, but Watson's telling the stories in the right order for us, the reader.
Chronology of the tale. We talked about this mm-hmm. with the detective story mm-hmm. and the backward thinking versus the forward exactly. thinking. Interesting.
That's exactly what it is.
Interesting.
Yeah.
is this the part where we grab a brandy and soda? Of course
it is.
Of course it is.
It wouldn't do any harm, Steve. it would. If I gulped it down, and then I'm ready.
A little bit of color come back to your face.
Exactly. He's just fine after that. Brandy is apparently
alcohol solves everything.
It's a
right?
magic elixir, apparently. I'm glad I have brandy on hand just in case somebody's fainting. Gregson enters. He has followed Eccles to Holmes. Surprise! It's Gregson. I didn't know that we were going to see Gregson again.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Lestrade's getting pretty old now, right? So we got...
Maybe retired. We don't know.
Because we met him in the book that we just read, the first Sherlock Holmes novel, and we didn't see him through any of the short stories until now.
That's right. He's back.
What a coincidence.
What an interesting timing that we just read that book.
That's right.
I know.
Well done.
That was planned out. Totally planned out. We knew this was going to be happening.
There are a lot of websites that give you like what's the best order to read Sherlock Holmes stories in. And there's a lot of different suggestions. And I feel like we've read them in a funny order, but I can kind of make the argument for the order we've read them in.
The machete there was nothing order planned is the best.
But it kind of works, right? To go from Study in Scarlet to His Last Bow. There's something kind of fun about it.
It's worked really well, especially with Gregson showing up here. Gregson announces sure. that Mr. Aloysius Garcia has been murdered, and he had a letter from Eccles in his pocket, which is why the police are searching for Eccles. It was a most furious assault. There were no footsteps or any clue to the criminals. We've got quite a mystery here.
And I love that Gregson is so Sherlock Holmes is like, okay, well, just, you know what? This guy was just about to tell us his story. You come on in and sit down and buddy, keep telling your story. Let's find out what happened. And Gregson is like, okay, sounds good. You know, even though this guy's a suspect, he's like, all right, perfect. Let's just hear the story together, which shows you again how much the relationship between Holmes and Gregson has changed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Over the years. Now, what Eccles describes is the worst dinner party ever, right?
No kidding. The whole time you're going, oh my goodness, everything is wrong.
And it's really interesting because even from the way that he talks about Garcia, there's something odd about it right from the beginning. He says, in some ways, we struck up quite a friendship, this young fellow and I. He seemed to take a fancy to me from the first. And there's something odd about this sort of middle-aged, very staid British gentleman, super respectable. And then this like younger, cool Spanish guy, Garcia. And so what's going on? Like already we're kind of like, how did he take a fancy to this guy? He invites him to his house for dinner. There's only one manservant, a melancholy, swarthy individual. He says the whole place was depressing. They have a tete-a-tete dinner, so just the two of them. And he was kind of expecting more people, I think. And the host is totally distracted. He's drumming his fingers on the table. He's gnawing at his nails. It's like, oh my God, this is terrible.
Yeah, that's
not after terrible. Dinner, he starts chain smoking.
Something's going on there.
He needs brandy.
Well, he could be from Barcelona. You never know, Steve. That could be how they do things.
Oh, dear. Then Garcia receives a letter while Eccles is in the house, but he doesn't say anything about it. And Eccles says, the dinner itself was neither well served nor well cooked, and the gloomy presence of the taciturn servant did not help to enliven us. This sounds like so painful. So Eccles is super relieved to head off to bed at 11 o'clock. And then, sometime later, Garcia looked in at my door. The room was dark at the time and asked me if I had rung. I said that I had not. He apologized for having disturbed me so late, saying that it was nearly 1 o'clock. I dropped off after this and slept soundly all night. This guy's a better sleeper than most, I would say. this like super creepy house that you don't really know why you're there and you're odd host has just awoken you.
He goes, are you asleep in there? It's 1 o'clock.
And then, just to make things even creepier, in the morning, Eccles rings his bell to get the manservant. Manservant does not appear, so he dresses himself. He seems to be a little annoyed by it. He goes downstairs and, quote, the foreign host, the foreign footman, the foreign cook, all had vanished in the night. That was the end of my visit to Wisteria Lodge. Sherlock Holmes was rubbing his hands and chuckling as he added this bizarre incident to his collection of strange episodes. I love it when Sherlock Holmes rubs his hands together.
Again, that is just simple shorthand for British men being excited. When you are British and you are excited, you don't make a lot of noise. You simply rub your hands together. That's how it works.
It's the best.
Well, and, you know, and this is like the ultimate ghosting, right? Come to my house for dinner. You wake up the next morning and there's no sign that anybody's there.
It's a rental house.
Gotcha. I know. But, you know, the rent's been paid.
And he goes and maybe he thinks that could be the idea here. Is they skipped out on the rent. No, the rent has been paid. It's a run-down rental house. This is a very strange dinner party for sure.
And I think it's interesting that Eccles is so focused on the fact that these are foreigners in London, right? Like the fact that he repeats the words three times, foreign host, foreign footman, foreign cook. And oh, by the way, like the foreign host, right? It's this very focus that these are Spaniards.
And I think Doyle is on purpose making this the most British stoic character and saying, here's the juxtaposition between his character and these characters.
And Eccles knows that Spanish food is awesome, so he's like really excited to come to this dinner party. And then, you know, it just turns out to be terrible.
Poorly prepared, poorly served.
The mysterious note that was delivered and then was discovered by Mr. Baines, who is the country detective, He's described pretty well here too. The country detective was a stout, puffy red man whose face was only redeemed from grossness by two extraordinarily bright eyes, almost hidden behind the heavy creases of cheek and brow. Wow. That's great description.
Right, you can there. Picture him perfectly, right?
Absolutely. I think that's his Tinder profile. It works out real well for him.
Train wreck.
But he's a smart detective, right? So again, the relationship with the police has really changed. Like, Mr. Baines is a very bright detective. He noticed the mysterious note. He found it from behind the grate and he pulled it out. And it's very mysterious indeed. The note says, "Our own colors, green and white. Green open, white shut. Main stair, first corridor, seventh right, green bays. Godspeed, D."
Hmm. Very mysterious, very encoded note of some sort.
I was trying to think if there was, I don't know how Spain is set up, if it's provinces or states or whatever they are, but you know, does it have a relationship to Spain in any way? I don't know. So this is the area that is, you know, certainly mysterious.
And Watson thought that too. The statement is, "It's a woman's writing done with a sharp pointed pen, but the address is either done with another pen or by someone else. It is thicker and broader, as you see." Hmm.
Well, yeah, and then it's interesting. So Holmes does come up with some new details that Baines has not observed. And then Baines really gives him credit for it. Unlike Lestrade and Gregson in that early study in Scarlet, Baines says, "I thought I had squeezed all the juice out of it, but I see there was a little over," he said. "I'm bound to say that I make nothing of the note except that there was something on hand and that a woman, as usual, was at the bottom of it." So he gives Sherlock credit.
You wanna unpack that one for us, Pam?
But guys, doesn't that remind you of that moment in A Study in Scarlet when Sherlock Holmes said, "Okay, there are three possible motives for this. Could have been robbery, clearly wasn't. Could have been politics, could have been a woman."
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, Baines is making that same analysis, right? They're kind of much more on the same wavelength. There's no competition with the police by this point in the canon.
Well, there are only three options. There are only three options.
And then, A, B, or C. It's like, let's make a deal. Behind curtain number one.
Holmes gets hired by Eccles and asks Baines if that's okay. Baines replies, "Oh, I would be highly honored, sir. I am sure." Holmes replies to that, "You appear to have been very prompt and businesslike in all that you have done." So yeah, that relationship with the police is different again here.
Yes, credit where credit is due on both sides. And then, of course, the police go off, and then Holmes and Watson have their own little tete-a-tete as they discuss it. And Holmes asks Watson, "What do you think? Who do you think wrote this letter? What do you think is going on?" And Watson says, "The man was a Spaniard. I suggest the D stands for Dolores, a common female name in Spain." Good, Watson. Very good. But quite inadmissible. A Spaniard would write to a Spaniard in Spanish. I love that.
It's so just like the two of them. Like, why would he try to decode the name of the woman? Spanish women are named Dolores. No, that's not a thing, Watson.
And
Watson can still see, but he can't see, right?
And Holmes and Holmes is like, "Ah, that is such a good try." And I feel like all of us who are teachers have done this, right?
Yes.
Where we're like, you know, that was a super good try. It's really not quite the answer that we were looking for. Let's give it another shot.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels very...
I hear that quite often.
Teachers, friends, partners, whatever.
This section comes to an end here.
So yes, so the ending, of course... Holmes and I had taken things for the night and found comfortable quarters at the Bull. Finally, we set out in the company of the detective on our visit to Wisteria Lodge. It was a cold, dark March evening with a sharp wind and a fine rain beating upon our faces. A fit setting for the wild common over which our road passed and the tragic goal to which it led us.
Beautiful narrative.
So immediately we understand why British people like to retire to Florida and to California. Because it's raining.
Always raining. Always raining, yes. London fog is my favorite brand because, yes, it's always raining and I always need my raincoat, so I wear my London fog all the time.
So, and that brings us to the end of this half, and we know that the second part is going to be called The Tiger of San Pedro.
Oh, boy.
What do we do with that? Very interesting.
I look forward to all the Tiger King references tomorrow.
Of course.
My name's Joe Exotic tomorrow.
Hey, we've already started. Okay, good. We're starting. Oh, good to hear. Glad you're here, Chip. So
it gets me a whole day to get highlights. You never know. Am I here?
So, I hope everybody is enjoying this. I hope everybody's listening along and getting into our new batch of short stories after getting through the novel. I hope everybody is having a great time out there and being wonderful to everybody, being good to people around you. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes and go to our dedicated website, sandwiches at irregularhours.com, and we'll be back tomorrow with the second half of this story. Exciting. I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea what's going to happen at this point.
There will be a tiger. That's what we know.
Exactly. Lots of the tiger. Lots again. Of oil. I know.
Go ahead, Chip. Go ahead. Say it. Lots of sardine oil.
There was a murder, Steve, or possible murder. They can't find the husband.
And a woman was involved. I want to thank you again.
And tigers.
I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenblatt.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
Where's my sandwich?
He goes, are you asleep in there? It's 1 o'clock. Exactly. I'm going to... Oh, thank you, Peach. No, it's me. Come here.